You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Erica Phillips, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Good to hear your voice again. If listeners wouldn't know this, but we recorded an episode a few months ago, and it was fatefully the first episode where this happened to me, but it was lost to the ether. But so much crazy stuff has happened recently that we've got a full stockpile of great stories to talk about. You are a reporter covering supply chain and logistics at the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, no. Did you hear my dog just there?
Sorry. That's fine. We'll keep it in. What's your dog's name?
Her name is Noble. She got very excited. Sorry about that.
Well, I was just about to say that you've been covering logistics and supply chain for a while. Is this the craziest time it's ever been? I feel like I'm reading front page news about logistics and supply chain on a daily basis right now.
Oh, that's interesting. There's always something crazy going on, because when I first started covering it, that was when all the ports on the West Coast were essentially not really moving cargo because of the labor discussions that were going on. So that was like the big story, you know, 2014-15. And then there was the Hanjin bankruptcy, I think 2016, which like left, you know, $14 billion worth of goods on ships in the middle of the ocean for several weeks. So there's always something crazy going on. But what specifically were you thinking of right now?
Well, the China tariffs, just like the trade war, seems, you know, particularly impactful to the whole worldwide economy.
Yeah, for sure.
The story about Apple and Amazon and Supermicro that was, I don't know exactly what the word is, but the story that Bloomberg put
gripping.
Out. Gripping. It's very, things are getting really weird. There's a lot of weird things about that story. Mm-hmm. Amazon is always a, you know, sort of looming thing that is always happening to us, around us. And they announced their $15 an hour wage increase, which just has some really profound ramifications, I think, for a lot of other companies.
Yeah, I was talking to someone last week or so, and it was the second time I'd heard someone use this word Amazonification, which, like, you'll never find me using that word in daily conversation, but just the idea that whatever Amazon does is going to filter into what everyone else does. It's like, you can't avoid it.
So maybe we start with that one. They announced that recently, like a week ago or something, a lot of states are pumping up their minimum wage to $15. So they're preemptively doing that across all states. I've also heard, though, that some of their workers are going to lose some of their benefits. I think it was around like profit sharing or something. I'm not totally sure what it was, some sort of bonus that they were getting.
I saw that headline, and I actually probably don't know enough to speak to that, but I do think the $15 an hour thing, you know, that was a piece of news that was huge. I mean, everyone seized on that. And the thing about that is everyone keeps talking about labor shortage. There's this, you know, very low unemployment rate. I think I'm working on a story right now just sort of about, in part, some of the implications of that for workers that have to get to pretty far locations. It's like workers sort of have the choice now, because they're in such high demand, of going wherever's most convenient, wherever offers good hours, or, you know, in this case, wherever pays them the best. And so the $15 an hour minimum wage is in part to be competitive for a tightening labor supply. But also I see it as like, that's exactly what should be happening. You know, when you can't find workers, you raise the wage, and guess what? You can find workers. So, it's the supply demand, the most basic economic principle. You know, Amazon, it gets all this like great press for offering this higher minimum wage, but it's very much a competitive strategy and based on really pretty basic economics, I think. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, one thing that's interesting is I don't think most people understand the scale of Amazon. They're 600,000 people now, something like that. And I think most of those people work in the warehouses, if you know, by percentage. So that's just a huge amount of extra capital. So it really shows that they believe in this and they're doing it across all of their warehouses all at once, not just, you know, California or New York or the places that have mandated this. So obviously, I think it's a good thing. There's always a certain percentage of people who are going to be skeptical about this. That I think Amazon has generally come under a lot of criticism for the condition of their, you know, warehouses and the labor conditions for mm-hmm. their workers. So mm-hmm. it's a little bit of a mix, right?
Right, right. That's kind of another thing that I've thought about quite a bit. I read a really long piece about, you know, someone went out and interviewed a bunch of people working at Amazon, and all of them, you know, had bones to pick with, you know, their shifts and their hours and the conditions and, you know, the physical work. And yes, like these jobs, they're not like pleasant jobs in a lot of ways. Also, as I understand it, you know, there are a lot of warehouse operators out there who are, you know, employing people in very similar, if not harsher conditions with fewer benefits, paying them less, that are not getting the kind of scrutiny that Amazon is getting, because Amazon is this big behemoth that sort of exemplifies the whole e-commerce ecosystem and what it means to work in e-commerce. And like, by all means, people should hold them accountable, but I think it shouldn't be at the expense of like other warehouse operators getting away with some of this stuff. And that's what's kind of, it starts to get kind of frustrating when it seems like one company is getting all this heat when, you know, I know of examples that are just far worse at places that, you know, Wall Street wouldn't necessarily care about because they're not public companies and they're sort of smaller operations. So I think, you know, there's something to be said for Amazon raising the minimum wage at their operations and kind of forcing the issue in some regard across the industry, and we'll see what happens. We'll see if that drives better wages for workers. But it is also true at the end of the day that these are like hard manual jobs, and they're like the sort of physical reality of how you get your e-commerce order. It's not super pretty. Sometimes it's hard to kind of accept that, and it's hard to want to think about it.
Well, and that's that's a little bit of the hypocrisy sometimes, where people will complain about the fact that Amazon's not paying their workers enough, but then if they started charging shipping to everyone and not letting you, you know, just get your Prime Amazon shipping and get all your stuff for free coming to your mailbox one at a time in these, you know, various size boxes, people would riot about that. So, but you were writing recently about the fact that in general, there needs to be more warehouse workers. There was some study, I think, that CBRE, the big investment group, real estate investment group, and was talking about, based on their projections, that we would need another 500,000 workers by the end of next year, by the end of 2019.
Right. So they did this estimate, and it's based on sort of the amount of new square footage of industrial space that's scheduled to like be completed within the next, whatever the time period was. I can't remember if 1 year or 2 years. I think it was 2 years. And based on that square footage and the understanding that it's about, you know, such and such number of workers per 1,000 square feet at any given warehouse on average, it came out to that we're looking at the need for like 400. I'm not looking at the story right in front of me, but what was it, like 450,000?
Yes, that's right.
Workers. Yeah. So
this was a story, if people want to look up, called E-commerce Driving Need for More Warehouse Workers, from September 5th. So it was 226,000 workers projected needed this year and next year.
Right. So the total was like 452,000 over the next 2 years. Right. So that's a huge number of workers. Now, there's a lot of different factors to kind of parse out of that. There's a lot of seasonality to the warehouse workforce. You know, a lot more people are working during the kind of the holiday rush. Then it dies down. There's, you know, kind of another big push in the spring, summer, and so on and so forth. You know, the shift work is varied depending on the type of operation, so on and so forth. But this overall sort of general estimate of 452,000 needed by the end of next year is a lot. I mean, in any given month, we look at the labor report every month, and it's like, at the peak season, you know, they're hiring, I think last month it was like 25,000 or so new workers for just for the warehouse. And we're talking about not just warehouse, we're talking about warehouse, e-commerce, you know, kind of some of the other categories that fit into that whole sector. But yeah, it's a heck of a lot, and like, who knows where they're going to come from. But again, if you raise the wage you're offering, sometimes workers appear. You know, there's, again, it's that like that sort of basic economic principle. That's a good way to get people out of the woodwork, is make those jobs pay a little bit more. I don't know. We'll see what happens.
That was what you were projecting, and I think that's what CBRE was saying in their study, mm-hmm. which was that it would get more competitive.
Right.
And that was a month ago, before Amazon announced increase. So it's a kind of an interesting parallel. I've also seen a lot of graphics floating around showing the death of retail and how malls are shutting down, and how all of those employees, you know, that there's a tremendous number of employees there that are losing their jobs. And those seem to be crossing paths at a roughly even rate.
Yeah, I had read a study recently that warehouse jobs actually pay better than traditional retail on an hourly basis. So there's kind of an incentive, again, sort of depending on the reality of kind of where you can get to and where you live and all that. But yeah, the warehouse jobs, tough as they are, they're very physically tough and so forth, but they do, on the whole, pay a little bit more. There was a Brookings study about that.
And so something that we're seeing at Lumi is a lot of our customers who are, you know, direct to consumer e-commerce brands, they're primarily using third party logistics companies. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are also using Fulfilled by Amazon. Amazon's like a service that allows you to fulfill from their warehouses.
Right.
Sometimes you obviously you can sell on Amazon, but you can also use their service to sell on your own website as well, and they'll do the fulfillment piece of it. It's just kind of interesting to see that it's not just Amazon driving this. Like, everyone who's shifting to an e-commerce first model needs that type of labor. It's not just if you want free shipping on your toothpaste. It's just about everything that you want to order online kind of goes through that process.
Through that picking, packing, shipping.
Picking, yeah. Packing, fulfillment. There have been companies that have focused on the robotics angle of that, and Amazon acquired one some years ago that was completely focused on, can we make this process robotic?
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like that is not outpacing the just the need, the pure need right now of like adding more people to warehouses.
That's true. Although I was just talking to someone today about automation in the warehouse, and this was actually someone at CBRE who was looking at the availability of warehouse space, and he was saying, you know, a lot of warehouse space is in demand right now because companies they want a fresh place to build out their automated warehouse plan, and that they're sort of shifting. There might be, you know, quite a number of companies trying to shift one of their old school operations into one of these much more automated operations. And that stuff is happening sort of as we speak. I met with a cool company actually here in Southern California, robotics company called Invia, and they're trying to develop robots in such a way that you don't need to go buy a new warehouse and build up a whole new infrastructure inside the warehouse. You can actually, you know, bring these robots into your existing operation and kind of phase them in pretty easily, because they basically do the main work that they do is the walking up and down the aisle. So they'll go and get it for you and come back, and you just pack it and ship it. And so there's a lot of thinking around that happening right now, that if we are going to move to automation, what's our budget for that? What's our plan for that? What does this base need to look like? And all of those questions are really happening right now. I think the labor is definitely a question. There's definitely kind of these big, scary estimates of how many people you're going to need. But there's also a lot of thought and money going into automation right now.
Yeah, I think this kind of relates to another big theme that you've been writing about recently around freight and a lot of these software platforms that are coming out that help you book freight. One of the biggest areas of innovation is also obviously around self-driving cars and self-driving trucks. And that's, mm-hmm. I don't know if you're writing about that much, but I saw some studies saying that, you know, in the United States, freight truckers are by far the biggest job population. And there's constantly this idea that all of those jobs are going to go away. It's interesting to see all of this play out. Like, what's the equilibrium point of all of it? Mm-hmm. Because we need a lot more of those people. And yet, like, automation is making those things more efficient or removing those jobs. It's hard to tell exactly where that is going to even out.
I don't know. For me, and just, you know, I'm talking to these companies and I'm moving around in this world every day, I think warehouse automation seems much further along. You know, it's very much happening. Like you said, Amazon bought Kiva. That was years ago. And you know, people have been experimenting with a lot of this stuff. But the self-driving vehicles, I mean, just in a really basic way, there's so many scary things about it. Like, as a person who drives, like, you know, I spoke with Uber's automated trucking, you know, pilot program people several months ago. And then that fizzled and went away because, you know, there was that horrible incident with the self-driving Uber car. And, you know, there are these general ideas of, like, you know, the driverless truck can go, you know, from point A to point B, and then a driver can come pick up the truck and drive it the last mile to wherever it needs to go. And it's all like, a lot of it makes a lot of sense, but I think there's so much like safety issues and also legal issues, you know, state laws, you know, crossing state lines is difficult, and just all of that stuff to get worked out, that it's hard for me to really see it happening all that soon. And so when these studies come out that are like self-driving trucks could eliminate such and such many trucker jobs, it's just like, I just feel like that's estimating something that's just so nebulous and like so far in the future. But that's coming from a very skeptical journalist. So, like, you know, take it with a grain of salt.
But do you see the, at least for warehouses and fulfillment centers, some sort of tapering off of, you know, we've got these hundreds of thousands of workers that are needed in the next few years, but how soon does that curve start to taper off where automation can take over some of those jobs or make those jobs more efficient?
Yeah, that's the $1 million question, I guess, right? Like
the $1 trillion question.
Bajillion. there's no way for me to know how fast it's going to happen, but these robots really are getting built and they are rolling around warehouse aisles. They're doing those jobs. So people are going to figure it out. Yeah. And it's like, how much does it actually reduce the need for labor? I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there are economic studies out there on this. You know, you're making me realize I need to go hunt one down and write a story about it.
This is your next story. Cause we've got that curve of like retail, all of those jobs are going away. All of these new jobs are being created in warehouses. What is like the most efficient warehouse, you know, that is like actively shipping a lot in America look like? How much more efficient can it get? And, you know, if all warehouses looked like that, what would that mean for the job market for those, you know, fulfillment center workers?
Yeah. And I, in some sense, like, it's hard to say that there's the one way that anything would look because the products are so different. Like, I was in a warehouse that was like, they sell party supplies. And so it was these huge shelves up to the ceiling, you know, with these really big bulky things and then some little tiny things. And they needed human people to pull a cart around and put stuff on, you know, various bins in the cart because it wouldn't have made sense for them. And I did ask, you know, would you ever have robots? But just it wouldn't have made sense for them to use the robot model. Now, on the other hand, there might be a internet business selling like very small little things that the shelves don't need to be that high and they're, you know, just this and that little thing. And so that's an easier thing for a robot to go grab, or like the Gap warehouse that has the robots that actually pick the individual articles of clothing. And so I think this is like the kind of answer that I hate to a question, but like, I do think that it varies what's the most efficient warehouse model, but and maybe there are warehouses where having a whole bunch of workers actually makes sense.
But you've also been writing about other kinds of technology entering the warehouse. You've been writing about the like consumerification, if we're going to add another ification.
Yeah.
to exactly. to this. Like Alexa was a theme. I don't even really get how those things are being used.
Yeah. So this is kind of a fun thing. Like I visited this company called Textile. Like if you know the internet brand Shoe Dazzle. Mm-hmm. And they own like a few internet brands like that. And they have in their warehouse, it was run by this guy who's worked in 3PLs. And he just said, it doesn't make sense to have these devices in here that are heavy that, you know, I have to train people to figure out like these sort of scanner gun things with all these buttons all over them. That he was like, I just want to do this on Apple devices because they already know how to use those. And I put an app on there and it's just tap, tap, tap. And so much easier to train people. And when you have this, you know, seasonality to your business, like you want people to come in and get up to speed that day. Like you don't have time to be like doing a training session. And then if someone strains their arm because it's too heavy, like, you know, you just want it to be as easy as possible. And so consumer electronics have kind of been the answer for a lot of warehouse operators in how to get people up to speed as quickly as possible. So in this case, they use iPods that are sort of outfitted with an industrial kind of battery and some other things that make it very durable in the warehouse. But it just is like using an app on an iPhone. And then there are other things like some freight operations that I talked to that were using emojis to like instead of bark, like numbers on a box, it was just like an emoji. And that's how you knew what box you needed to go get and that sort of thing. And then most recently, there was a shipping company I talked to called Shipping Easy that has built an app for Alexa. So if you're in the warehouse and you're trying to do, you know, trying to pack a shipment, you don't have to go over to the computer and click through and find the shipment and go print the label. Like you just tell Alexa to print the label and, you know, frees up your hands. So all these kind of things that they're consumer electronics. So they're very intuitive and that makes it possible for people to walk into a workplace and sort of know immediately how to operate the equipment, which is pretty cool.
It reminds me of the military started to see this happening as well, you know, even as,
oh, really?
Right, as early as the first or second generation of iPhone, it was already better than any of the electronics that the military was like outfitting the troops with, which is kind of crazy. And I remember this is somewhat related. I'm not totally sure how, but Strava, the company that makes like workout tracking apps and devices. Basically, Strava decided to put out this map that was like a heat map of the world where you could go find trails, like the most popular trails based on the patterns of what people were doing. And they didn't like remove any of the data. So you could go to basically any place in Afghanistan or Iraq and just see exactly where
right.
the military bases were by these square yeah. patterns where people are working out and just doing laps around the base.
Yeah, I remember this. Oh my God.
But it's kind of interesting and it will tie to another story that I want to get into, you know, the Bloomberg story. But as you introduce these consumer devices into these places, it just seems like you open yourself up to all kinds of weird security things or totally unpredictable problems that might come up.
Well, yeah, if you, I don't know. I mean, what would the scenario be like?
Well, if you have an Alexa inside of your warehouse, now you've got this consumer device. Like, isn't, I'm just saying that Alexa is owned by Amazon. Amazon is trying to like take over all of logistics. You're putting an Amazon Alexa inside of your warehouse. I don't know. I'm not trying to like create some controversy or some conspiracy
theory,
but it's just like seems kind of like an interesting combination of choices. We're constantly
worth pointing out. It's certainly worth pointing out. Yeah.
yeah. I'm just putting some dots
just
out there.
Saying. You guys. Yeah.
But people, I mean, there's these, it's not even like it's a conspiracy. Amazon, there was another story that came out this week and I'm constantly fascinated by how brands are, you know, making this choice over and over again to work with Amazon. I love buying stuff on Amazon and it's just the inevitability of it seems so crazy that Amazon is increasingly promoting their own products next to products from competing brands. They're using their private label to show off the new t-shirts that they're selling at, you know, a fraction of the price of a similar t-shirt from a brand. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of fascinating to me that they're able to do that, like in in the face of the brands that are selling on their platform, and the brands just have to do it because that's their biggest sales channel.
Yeah, there's something going on there. And it's like, if you go to Target, I sort of always, I've done this on Twitter a few times, so I'm sort of always thinking about, because I grew up going to Target like at least once a week because I grew up in Minneapolis. And so that's very, it's sort of very familiar to me. And I always try to think of what Amazon is sort of in relation to that Target experience that I've had all my life. And so if you think about it, all it is it's the same way Target puts their Up and Up brand next to,
right next to Kleenex or whatever.
Yeah, Febreze or whatever. And you're looking at the price and that's all you're looking at. At least in my case, I'm a very cheap person, but, but is that all it is maybe? Or is there something a little more complicated to it? I was thinking about how Amazon, because they have unlimited quote unquote shelf space, right? They're just a website. Mm-hmm. There's no, at Target, you know, if you want a bathroom cleaner or something, you know, there's only going to be a few choices, even though in the world, there's probably like 400 million different cleaners, but they have to, you know, their buyers have to select what we think our customers are going to look for. And then we have our own off brand and whatever, whatever. But in a world where there's just this unlimited shelf space, it's like going into Target and then there's just this whole area of Target that's like a random like pile of anything you could ever think of, but it's not organized very well. And it's never the right size of the thing you want. You know, you have to like dig for the right quantity or the right size. And so I always just sort of think about that in terms of like the customer experience of Amazon and like, what is actually happening on that web page, like when you go there. And you know, the end result, like you're saying, is that Amazon's own products are going to probably rise to the top, unless it's something just really extremely popular. And so what does that mean? I don't know. That means we get pretty low prices, but what does it mean for brands and so on? Like, it's just a very interesting way that I think about it.
There was a point at which I think YouTube has surpassed it now, but Amazon was like the second most popular search engine after Google.
Oh yeah, I remember that, yeah.
and now it's probably third or something, or maybe fourth, I don't know. But it's still a place that people go to find stuff. And at least for me, the search functionality of Amazon has just declined. Very much in sync with the number of products that they've added, because it's so overwhelming. If you're trying to look for a toilet brush and there's 700,000 different ones, and you know, now that they've got all of these issues with counterfeiters,
yeah, and that's the other thing, that
fake
yeah,
reviews exactly. and stuff, like the trust level is so low. And I think Jeff Bezos is always harping on the idea of like, you know, customer happiness is the number one thing, but I don't know. Like, yes, they're really good with returns and that kind of stuff, but I don't know that the user experience of it has really improved. I think it's getting worse all the time.
Again, getting back to the, I don't know if it's obnoxious, but like getting back to sort of comparing it to the Target model, there was something, and again, maybe this is because I'm from Minneapolis and I grew up there, but there was like this trust that like if Target's selling it, it's probably like they've probably vetted it to some extent. Like I had sort of a, in right or wrong, whether, you know, that trust was warranted or not, you were like, well, I've never heard of this brand, but it's at Target, so it's probably good. Right. And so that was fine, but I don't have that with Amazon. If I haven't heard of a brand, it's on Amazon. I have no idea, you know.
Well, even if you have heard of the brand and you buy the product, you don't even know if it's going to be real or not. That's the crazy part.
Yeah, like when you buy stuff through Instagram, and like, I don't know if you've done that, but
no.
I've done that a couple times, and it is sort of like, I'm like, well, you know, shruggy. Like I hope this shows up. Like I don't know. You know, I've never heard of this company before, and here I am, like shelling out money because they had a really good Instagram ad. And sometimes the stuff comes and it's not great. Yeah, I mean, you can send it back, but like there's that sort of weird thing happening too.
Yeah, there was a great story from Christopher Mims, came out a couple days ago, why you're buying products from companies you've never heard of.
Mm-hmm, totally.
Just great examples of all of that stuff. Micro brands.
But, you know, I do just want to say, like, I have had some very good experiences with the things I bought through Instagram. So I'm not making a full-on judgment call or anything there.
No, I mean, I think there's a ton of them, you know, that pop up on Instagram that I have never heard of. And if you look them up, there was this great story a while back that I'll have to dig it up, where it's essentially just a front for something that is just being mass produced in China and being relabeled a bunch of different ways by different companies that are just, all they're doing is slapping a logo on something that, you know, is an off the shelf product made by a Chinese factory. So I've seen this comment come up over and over again when talking about these micro brands, which is that the whole point, I'm not saying this is my opinion, but this is the opinion of some people, was that the point of a brand was to be some sort of like certificate of trust. Like, it's kind of like the Target thing that you're talking about, but at the brand level, if it has the name, whatever, Nike on it, then I can trust that that's going to be a decent product. Mm-hmm. But now that we're commoditizing or democratizing the idea of what a brand is, and everybody can just sort of spin up a brand,
yeah,
is it even a brand if it doesn't carry the purpose of being a thing that you can trust?
That's really interesting. Yeah. And that's sort of what Mims was getting at in that column, is just sort of this huge swath of these very creative names and pretty logos, but how do you differentiate? And you know, there are good ones among them, sure, but there's plenty of, like you mentioned the story, it was by Alexis Madrigal, I think, yes, in The Atlantic.
It's so good.
Where, you know, he orders this thing that looks like a beautiful cashmere coat, and it just came and was sort of janky and like wasn't yeah, there's sort of this potential for it to just be completely catfished, essentially, by like a fake brand, right? It's a brave new world.
But to go back to that Target comparison you were making, I think the big difference is that Target was not as good at using the data that they had about their competitors. I think there's a fancy word for this, but their collaborators, the brands that they bring into the Target store that they're competing against at the same time, whatever data that they were getting around, okay, let's move into this space, or let's like choose to make this weird product because it looks like we're selling a lot of it. It doesn't seem like they were either getting that data the same way, or they weren't acting on it as quickly. Amazon seems to be like not at all afraid to try all kinds of crazy stuff and just about every consumable product now has an Amazon branded version. You know, you look at batteries or power cords, everything. And now it's going into clothing and all kinds of gadgets and stuff. So just kind of fascinating to ask ourselves, you know, where does it end? Are they literally going to make private label versions of everything? And it goes to the famous like Jeff Bezos quote of your margin is my opportunity, which just sounds scarier and scary over time.
Right. It's like really ominous. And yeah, I was talking to like freight forwarder who was, you know, just saying that they discourage their clients from kind of letting Amazon in on that data on their shipping. Because I think there was something where like Amazon was doing some freight forwarding, right? They're helping you ship stuff from your factory and in wherever over to your warehouse here. But this freight forwarder is just cautioning like, okay, then you're giving Amazon the address of the place that you make your thing that you sell on Amazon. So like,
This is my point about the Alexa in the warehouse. I'm not even saying that they're using it for like nefarious. They're not like snooping in. I'm not even saying that. I'm just saying there's an app on the Alexa that presumably is being installed to run these commands of like print me a label. Mm-hmm. That's enough. Like the fact that there is an app running on an Alexa inside this location that's doing this kind of stuff is enough for them to have interesting data that can, it just.
Okay. But I mean, isn't everything on AWS servers already?
Oh God. I'm going full conspiracy mode now.
Where is this conversation gone?
Well, let's keep going down this.
Oh no.
Things are getting weird and talk about this Bloomberg story. Okay. Do you feel like you could summarize it?
Ooh, let's see. I read it a week ago, so let's see. There was a company called a U.S.-based company called Supermicro that made motherboards for
servers, I think.
Apple and like for a bunch of like big companies, including like the Defense Department and other government entities and. The technology was billed as very secure. It was like, you know, you wanted to use that stuff for the servers where you needed like a high security thing. But some of the contractors that they were using to put together those motherboards in China were, you know, subcontracting out to some other factories that somewhere back there got compromised, and there was...
Allegedly.
You're right. Okay. Yes, definitely. But there was this effort that to put this tiny microchip in these motherboard components that made it hackable, basically, right? And then, so then there's actually, according to this reporting, servers in all of these very high profile places that are potentially just openly leaking information to whoever was behind this effort to install these weird tiny little microchips. They're like the size of like a grain of rice or something, right?
Well, yeah. And this is the part where something has got to give about this story, because Apple and Amazon were both mentioned as being targeted, and both of them came out in the most strongest defense possible saying that that was not true, that they've done countless studies internally to verify this based on, you know, the inquiries from Bloomberg over the course of a year or something like that. Mm-hmm. It just seems to be that someone's lying somewhere, because mm-hmm. not all of these things can be true at the same time. But Bloomberg had this very evocative cover image of like this finger with a mm-hmm. tiny chip that was, you know, smaller than a grain of rice.
Right, right, right.
And I think the scary thing that they're positing is just, we as an economy in the US rely so much on Chinese manufacturing. It's easy for those things to be compromised. That stuff happens all the time already. Hmm. It is happening. It's happening all the time. Counterfeit stuff is being made all the time,
right,
and sold as real. That is a true fact. What if this could happen with electronics and really important you know, high security stuff that big companies or even the government might be using.
Right.
So really just like stoking a bigger fear, whether or not this particular story turns out to be true.
Right. So just sort of the broader, like the security of your supply chain in general, you know, how easy would it be for you, you know, if you make some really high end handbags or something for your factory, wherever it is, to just make, you know, several dozen extra of those and go sell them themselves, or, you know, have someone who wants to sell them on the black market. Yeah. Like you're right. That's happening all the time. And this story kind of points out, I mean, just like the worst, you know, like scariest example.
Yes. It's positing what's the worst thing mm-hmm. that could happen? And obviously it's just saying that component was added. It hasn't said, oh, you know, and it resulted in this or that information being right. stolen or something like that. So it hasn't gone full circle on it. And it seems like that story came out, you know, a week ago as we record this. It's still in the cycle of being refuted by certain people. So it's just literally, even to the today, being bounced back and forth between Apple's PR, which seems to be taking a really strong stand against it, and Bloomberg, which is dripping out in very small amounts, like some of their sources and some of the information behind it, without really giving very much detail yet. And so now people, this is why it's like full conspiracy mode. This is what I was saying at the very beginning of the show. It can be more, you can be more on your, on the edge of your seat if you care about logistics and supply chain at this point. But people are asking themselves, who benefits from this story being out there? Because Apple doesn't benefit. Supermicro, which is the company that has lost half of their share as a public company. And was it planted by the U.S. government to encourage this, like, tariffs and the trade war with China, and to promote American manufacturing, which has been a big thing for Trump, especially like pushing Apple to get more involved in that? Or was it planted by China to make people distrust the media in America and all this kind of stuff? I don't know. People are going full conspiracy mode. All right.
That's I'm not with you on either of those theories.
I'm not saying, I'm just trying to like illustrate the variety of points that are coming out of this story, because it seems like somewhere, it doesn't seem like it benefits the Bloomberg to have this. Bloomberg is a very, you know, well-regarded publication as well. So who benefits from all this is a kind of a weird angle on this. I don't know if you have a take on it.
Well, I mean, as a journalist, you know, all you're ever going for is the truth. This is a fascinating thing. I think they said in the story they had 18 sources from different places. I think it was 18, which is a lot. Sort of verifying the reporting that they had done. I'm usually not inclined to like immediately trust PR that's responding to something this explosive. I mean, it's
sure.
there's a whole cottage industry called crisis management that, you know, this is what they deal with, and you have to have a statement, but I'm sure they're doing their own investigating. And it's like a lot of things. When the first story comes out, there's a lot of, like you said, kind of a trickle, you know, there's more information that comes forward. There's more, this will be kind of, I think, fleshed out in the weeks and months to come of what really happened. And if it does turn out that Bloomberg somehow got duped by 18 people who corroborated each other, that alone is insane. Like that's why that would be wild. And you know, it would really hurt that publication's credibility. So if their editors are going with the story, you know, there's something to it. Absolutely, there's something to it. But yeah, I think it sort of remains, there's sort of some time that needs to pass and some investigation that needs to happen, and we'll get a bigger view of what happened. But in any case, in terms of like the industry that you and I work in, it's a story very much worth telling. Just to sort of point once again to kind of the security of supply chains and how, you know, there's really a lot in anyone's supply chain that is very vulnerable at any given time. And it's really difficult to have a handle around all of those things. And you see it time and time again in really
sure
like horrible crises that happen in factories, and you know, the kind of stuff I hear about, the kind of stuff you hear the government reporting on, you know, labor conditions and safety and so forth all over the world, and wages and everything, that you name it. But all of that stuff, you can think that it's not in your supply chain and then find out years later that it was. There's all kinds of just uncertainty the further up you go. So that's part of why this story was really compelling to me, is that there's always a subcontractor, and there's always a subcontractor's subcontractor, and you don't know that person, you know, you've never met. So what could possibly be happening? Anyone's guess, you know, sometimes that's the stuff that scares me. And it's not really a conspiracy. It's like, reality.
Well, there are, I remember seeing these stories come out around things like olive oil, extra virgin olive oil. I'm sure you saw that. It was something like 95% of all olive oil sold in the United States that's labeled as extra virgin actually isn't, or something like that. And there's all these, you know, various publications have done their own testing around this kind of stuff and like recommended brands that are actually real. And that's a very simple thing that any consumer can understand. Okay, the olive oil that I'm buying is actually, you know, diluted with some other type of, you know, cheaper grade oil, or isn't, wasn't actually extra virgin, but was labeled as such. You know, there's big money, I guess, in olive oil, and that's why people are doing that. But also, does it really matter to the end consumer? Like, most people probably can't tell the difference anyway, so it doesn't matter. But with this particular story, it does, because you know, the government security is at stake. And so it's just kind of fascinating to see that come up as front page news right at the time when we're in the middle of this, you know, tariff and trade war. You've been writing a little bit about that too, or there's been quite a lot in the in your section of the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
About tariff dodging and all that kind of stuff. I don't know. Do you think that they're correlated in any way, these two stories, or it just happens to be that right now the U.S. and China are at it on a bunch of stuff around the supply chain?
Ooh, yeah. Whether it's related, I don't know. I mean, these are two huge economies with in hugely powerful countries with a lot of people that have a lot of varied interests in money and power. And so there's a lot there. But in terms of the trade issues and this, essentially this is being driven by this idea that our trade deficit with China was too big. Now, I think that's debatable. I think like a lot of economists would have, you know, vocally disagreed with that. But, you know, there are other dynamics between the US and China over intellectual property and other evidence that China's taking trade secrets, and it's like there's a lot of baggage.
There's a lot of layers, and there's a lot of different people who care about different things in this whole.
Yeah. So, I mean, the coverage that I've been doing in particular is sort of about, well, how does this play out, you know, when you adjust tariffs on this and that product between the US and China? How does it play out in sort of the real world of like moving stuff? And there's some interesting things. You mentioned, you know, products getting sent under different codes to get around the tariffs. There's also just, you know, there were these deadlines for the tariffs. So there was like few months of like a ton of stuff getting shipped early so that they would beat the tariffs. And now that there are warehouses that are, you know, filled to the brim with inventory because people are trying to get ahead of that penalty. And there's some other really interesting things happening in terms of if you actually don't ship your product over here, but rather fulfill e-commerce orders from China.
Right.
If you're sending it, you know, in these smaller quantities in a postal service or something,
right,
there's actually ways that you can avoid the tariff. And so there's sort of some really interesting maneuvering happening very specifically in our world, in sort of the world of shipping, that I've been hearing about. That's really interesting and creative, I should say.
Yeah, people are. I've heard also of Chinese manufacturers are feeling the pinch as well because their main customers are U.S. companies, so they're trying to figure out, you know, how to not just dodge it but open up operations in other countries in Southeast Asia, or do, you know, these kinds of creative tricks like you're describing. Can we send it as finished inventory or something and get around it that way?
Oh, I heard something interesting that you can fulfill orders out of China and actually have a return label that has a US address. Mm. So it like,
I think that's what Apple does for most of their phones.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Very interesting stuff. There's like transshipping, that was in our story about the tariff codes and things getting kind of shipped through Singapore or, you know, other places to avoid. And I'm not clear that any of this is legal, but it's sort of these various tactics, like, you know, like how stuff from North Korea was getting into China and no one realized it. It's, there's these ways that people have to kind of maneuver around the system.
We're an hour into the podcast, so if people are still listening, I'm just going to say this is when I'm going to go full, you know, meta on this whole thing, because if there's anyone still listening, they'll appreciate this. But is this like the result of globalization to some extent, where the way that the U.S. and China depend on each other so much that this is the only way that we can actually have some kind of war? Like, how far does this go in terms of the two countries being able to push each other around? Does this like result in even bigger conflicts? It doesn't seem like it's getting any better. You know what I mean?
Like, would a trade war lead to an actual war? Is that what you're asking?
Well, I think it seems impossible at this point, but where does it, like, when will, you know, the leaders of both countries be satisfied that this has been a positive thing for both?
I don't know. Like, and if you've ever taken like a macroeconomics class and you had to walk through different scenarios, this is like your case study now. I mean, I feel like this is being taught and it's going to be taught in macroeconomics classes, because, you know, you shift a tariff on this and that, then suddenly factories in Mexico are building this thing now. And Costa Rica suddenly builds up its, I mean, I'm making this up, but like,
sure,
suddenly there's a huge textile boom in Costa Rica. And then suddenly there's a, you know, auto part component part factories in Malaysia. Like, and it's wild how quickly this is all happening. And it all comes back to kind of that whole theory that like trade will find a way. It's like a river. It's going to figure out the quickest way to get from point A to point B. So the countries are going to have their tit for tat, like we've been calling it, but the show must go on. Like, stuff's going to get made. It's going to get made somewhere. And then when it all shakes out, I don't think it's very clear who the winner or loser is going to be. And there could be some pretty random
side effects.
Winner. Yeah. I don't know. I really think that some interesting things are going to happen in Mexico and Canada, as a result of all this. And I'm really fascinated by that component of it, where the issue is with China, but the result is Mexico's economy gets a great boost or something. You know, there's sort of a lot of interesting things. So I don't know, you know, to your question, which I don't remember now, but
I'm just asking. I guess it's an interesting, we have all over the world a surge in populist thinking where, you know, everyone's kind of feeling the desire to get a little bit more insular and focus on your own population or something like that. But we live in a world that's, today with the internet, with supply chains being completely cross boundaries and all these different things, where it's kind of like whatever the metaphor is, the genie is out of the bottle or the something, it's just too complicated to make it to really be completely independent. You know, you kind of have to depend on these other people.
Right. So I guess the big theory that I've heard about, which probably does answer your question, is people saying things like globalization is shifting to regionalization. So we might not see as many ships going back and forth across the Pacific. It might be more of a supply chain kind of between the US and Central America, that might make more economic sense. And people have been saying that actually even before this trade war started. That theory has been kind of bubbling around, and you know, that because China has all these connections with all these Southeast Asian countries and India and Africa, you know, and there's a lot of development happening in that kind of regional, you know, economy. So that might be end game, but I don't know.
Good. Plenty of fuel for the next few months of stories.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you're thinking about these days that you're planning on for upcoming writing?
Oh, yeah, but I guess everyone will just have to read it.
All right. Well, we'll put the links in the show notes. You're also still part of putting together the logistics report, right? The email newsletter.
Yeah, there's a daily newsletter called WSJ Logistics Report. I write it once a week. It's usually written by my editor, and lots of good logistics content in there for all of your varied interests, whether it be bunker, oil ships, or bubble wrap. So everything in between.
I saw this quote on your Twitter. It was just great. From Marion Gross, the Senior Vice President Supply Chain Management for McDonald's. For us, pickles are extremely important. And that's true. It's just so fascinating. I just am endlessly curious about how everything gets made and moved around the world. So if people are like me, they should read your columns, read your newsletter. It's great stuff. Thank you so much, Erica.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.